Strict Scrutiny is brought to you by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. It's everywhere right now, the celebration of America's 250th, and we are in the thick of it this month. Christian nationalists are using this milestone not to unite but to divide. They're pushing the lie that America was founded to be a Christian nation, where just one religious movement gets to decide who fully belongs, instead of the truth that America was founded as a democracy committed to liberty and justice for all. That's propaganda, not patriotism. It's a dangerous lie meant to justify censorship, discrimination, attacks on public schools, assaults on LGBTQ plus rights, restrictions on reproductive freedom, and government favoritism toward one extremist version of Christianity. Americans United for Separation of Church and State is here to fight back against this dangerous and egregious misinterpretation of our founding documents. AU fights daily for everyone's ability to live as themselves and believe as they choose, so long as they don't harm others. Novel idea in the day and age when almost every day we're seeing Christian nationalism weaponize a faith to attack individual freedoms across the country. Do something patriotic this summer, as you're dodging the propaganda flying at you from all angles. Become a member of Americans United. By supporting AU, you're committing to stand up and protect church-state separation in every area of life. Learn more about how you can support and how AU protects everyone's rights at au.org/crooked.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. It's an old joke, but when a man argues against two beautiful ladies like this, they're going to have the last word.
She spoke not elegantly, but with unmistakable clarity. She said, "I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks."
Welcome back to Strict Scrutiny, your podcast about the Supreme Court and the legal culture that surrounds it. I'm your sole regular host for today, Leah Littman. We're still on summer break and summer schedule, hot, strict scrutiny summer and all. So while Kate has been holding down the fort for the last 2 weeks, this week it's just me. And joining me today in the guest host chair is Emily Amick. Emily is former counsel to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, but better known to you all as Emily in Your Phone on Instagram and Substack. She's also the co-author of Democracy in Retrograde, a self-help guide to building a better civic life for everyone. Welcome back to Strict Scrutiny, Emily.
Hey, Leah. I'm so happy to be here.
I am happy you are here as well. We should say we are recording this on kind of a hotspot on Emily's phone, so unclear exactly what is going to happen, but that is the situation and that's how committed we are to getting this to you.
You know, technology is, making life wonderful, but also challenging us at every moment.
Indeed. So later in the episode, you'll hear a conversation I had with Equal Employment Opportunity Commission Commissioner, the sole remaining Democratic-appointed EEOC Commissioner Kalpana Kotagal, about the fallout from the court's decision in Trump versus Slaughter and the demise of agency independence, focused specifically on the EEOC as a formerly independent agency. But before that, Emily and I are going to chat legal news, and we're going to cover a lot of immigration-related developments in the courts and the executive branch. And I think the basic themes of the episode are going to be dude process instead of due process, and why are men's? And I should just say, bring on the emails telling me I am too mean to men. I can take it. I just got back from vacation. I am happy.
Don't send me those emails because I
no,
already
just
know.
Just me. Right? Well, I mean, I already know. I hear this all the time.
Men, I think they should just stop doing bad things and then we won't be mean to them anymore. This is my theory.
That sounds like a plan. I'm on board with that. But if you're thinking, I listen to these episodes all the time, what am I getting out of them? Well, do I have news for you? If you're a lawyer looking for fun new ways to get your CLE credits, listening to Strict Scrutiny is now one way to do it. We just launched our first course. It's our SCOTUS term recap episode that came out the first week of July. And right now it's approved for California, New York, and Pennsylvania. And we'll keep you updated as more states are added. This is something new we're trying. So if enough people sign up, we'll hopefully add more episodes in the future. Go to crooked.com/strict_CLE. To learn more and buy the course. Once you've purchased, you'll head over to our partners at Lawline, an accredited CLE provider responsible for CLE administration, to access it for course credit. Happy continuing educationing to all.
That seems like a great solution to an ever-present problem.
I love this idea. I am hoping it works and takes off because, Yeah, it could be.
I feel like
fun.
I'm always cramming to do those CLEs in the last 24 hours before they're due.
And why not binge on some podcast episodes,
exactly.
Right? Like, everyone teaches, everyone learns, everyone wins. Okay. Now, the segment I am calling Due Process Down / Due Process in Retrograde. And yes, that is a callback to Emily's great book, Democracy in Retrograde. So the New York Times ran a story documenting its analysis of hundreds of cases that have been brought by the Trump administration against protesters and immigrants, often related to dubious allegations that people supposedly assaulted immigration officers, and the Times analyzed more than 500 cases. And of the 400 that have already wrapped up, almost half went nowhere, either because defendants were acquitted or charges were dismissed by courts or prosecutors. As the Times notes, that's like an astonishingly bad record for the federal government, which rarely loses in criminal cases and resolves more than 90% of those cases through guilty pleas. And the Times concluded that, quote, the review suggests that the administration's use of the law has often been less about protecting federal agents than about providing legal cover to cow protesters and immigrants into submission. You think?
Yeah. And, you know, these cases are getting dismissed. 191 are dismissed, 22 acquittals. Normally in prosecutions, there's a 90% success rate. So we're seeing, you know, what is obviously these prosecutors are bringing cases they know they can't win. And in a huge number of these cases, in a shocking number, the people that they are going after, there was no assault. There was no even touching of these federal officers. People are driving their cars and beeping and yelling things and then getting accused of these shenanigans. And this is clearly part of this ongoing effort by the administration to use the idea of threatening the public from going against immigration officials. They don't want the oversight. They don't want all of us to be recording these bad acts by these immigration officials. And there was sort of a little bit of time that they started letting up on immigration enforcement, but I think as we've seen from recent killings in Texas and in Maine, they are clearly ramping back up again.
Yeah, no, they are back at it. And even though most of these cases resulted in dismissals or acquittals, which is terrific, we should still say, like, the process of undergoing all of that is still a punishment. And, you know, it's important not to ignore that. But the federal government still seems to be really looking for a way around the due process freaks that are the grand juries, juries, law, and federal courts, because it is now trying to make use of an entirely different court that has never actually been operational, and that is the so-called Alien Terrorist Removal Court. That court was created by Congress in 1996, and it's a court with five federal judges who are appointed by the Chief Justice, and it reviews applications for the removal from the United States of, quote, alien terrorists. The attorney general or the deputy attorney general files those applications under seal. And actually, the government can try to remove someone on the basis of secret evidence, national security information that the individuals will never see. And that allows the United States to quickly deport foreign nationals deemed to be, quote, alien terrorists and maybe some of their family members. And it defines, you know, as, quote, alien terrorists, not just people who have committed terrorism, but people who plan to.
You know, this is very much a conceptual cousin of FISA courts.
Yes.
And it's fascinating to me as someone who worked in anti-terrorism litigation for a very long time. I had never even heard of this secret court.
Me either.
And of course, that's because it's never been used. And so why would you hear of it? I loved the line from the judge in their decision in this case. I want to read it. It is so sassy, and lawyers in the audience will appreciate this. The answers persuaded the court that the government could benefit from the opportunity for more thoughtful consideration.
Help me help you.
Help me help you. Why don't you go back and reconsider? So, you know, this is like an interesting thing to comment on because fundamentally we know nothing. We don't know who is being charged, what they are. Like, what is terrorism with this administration, you know, in their effort to go after quote unquote left-wing terrorism? Who knows what this person is being accused of? As commentary, this is also confusing because on the one hand, you would think, okay, this is part of the administration's efforts to fast track their deportation efforts because this secret court is moves conceptually quicker. Mm-hmm. However, it's also a court that employs Article III judges.
Yes.
Who are not going to engage in the shenanigans right. that these Trump loyalist deportation officials, you know, the Trump administration, as a side note, has ramped up their hiring of immigration judges. We are almost at 200 so far in this fiscal year. That is more than the three previous fiscal years combined. They are clearly trying to ramp up the system. That's something we're going to discuss more later. They've also fired nearly 200 immigration right. judges. Of course, there's multiple pending lawsuits for discrimination against women and people of color for being fired. We can all guess what's happening there.
Right. Yeah. Should say our friend Steve Vladek has a great explainer on the Alien Terrorist Removal Court if you want to learn more. And as Emily, you were alluding to, while it does allow for more expedited procedures, there are also some additional protections, you know, like the fact that it's staffed by Article III judges. But I do want to get to the like ramp up you were alluding to, which is the administration taking a by any means necessary approach to depriving people, often new citizens, of their due process rights. So Boston's primary NPR news station, WBUR, actually where we recorded one of our first live shows, side note, Anyways, I know, so fun. They had a super important story about the development in immigration proceedings. The administration is initiating mass proceedings. Immigration lawyers are calling these mega masters hearings. The WBUR story focused on Boston, but additional stories have described the same in New York and Chicago. Basically, the administration is loading up immigration dockets. Just to take one example, one immigration judge had more than 100 people's immigration cases on her docket one morning. Obviously, several times the typical caseload, and, you know, she would call in about a dozen people every half hour.
That is shocking, you know, and these people are not being afforded what I would consider proper due process, right? Like they are not being given translators to help them understand what's going on. And it is part and parcel of this larger project we're seeing. I'll say the Washington Post also recently reported on the conditions under which people are being held in detention. And they're reporting that more than 80 people are being kept in a single detention room. There's increasing needs for hospital visits. Of course, we've all heard the stories about what's been going on in the sort of ICE detention camps overseas, but this is overseas, Emily. Texas is not overseas. I grew up in Texas.
I understand the mistake. This is a state where Ted Cruz, you know, is elected as
right
a,
there, yeah, guys. Right. We can all talk to my therapist later. But it's also happening in these detention facilities in New York, for example, where people are just being crowded in. And this is something we'll talk about later, which is the detention itself is meant, and the horrific conditions is meant to be a deterrent because this administration wants people to quote unquote self-deport.
Yep. And this too seems to be, that is like the max hearings, the mega masters. It's part of an effort to ramp up deportations, you know, in addition to those self-deportations, because this ramping up could generate removal orders, because what the administration is doing, they take a huge group of people that have hearings that might be scheduled for, you know, the next several years, and they send them a letter, that a physical letter, rescheduling all of their cases, you know, to next week. And some people probably aren't going to be able to get there, and they will miss court, and then they will be ordered removed, deported in absentia. And then, right, they can say, well, we get to remove them. Okay, so the administration has really been on this anti-due process kick, which borders are Tom Homan made clear in an impromptu presser. We'll play some clips, and Emily, I'll get your reaction, though I also have some thoughts.
Yes, let's do it.
Let's do it.
It comes down to one simple fact. These people fail to comply with law enforcement. Even some of the major chiefs in this country who don't necessarily agree with this administration, says you always comply with law enforcement. But the hateful rhetoric that ICE isn't a real law enforcement agency, I see these signs they resist. ICE are let's abolish them, they're fascists. When you keep that hateful rhetoric up for a year and a half, there's gonna be that percentage or that part, that left population that's gonna be emboldened to take action because they're not a real law enforcement agency, I should resist them. All they had to do is simply comply with law enforcement. If you don't like what law enforcement did to you, then go to the court, sue, call the ACLU, do whatever you want to do. But you should always comply with law enforcement. If they did, they'd be alive today.
Emily, what do you think about that?
Hey, if you don't comply, we'll kill you.
You die, right? Obey or die.
I was in my mind while he was talking, thinking about like, what are we going to talk about? Bivens now? You know what I mean? And like, oh, are there malicious prosecution claims that could be brought here and blah, blah, blah. But like, oh, I'm sorry, Tom, you're just murdering people.
Right.
Also, what does it fucking matter if you're dead?
What is Renee Nicole Good or Alex Preddy supposed to do when the agent is shooting at them? Like, file a habeas petition? It's just, like, it makes zero sense. And also, like, his agency doesn't obey court orders, right? And so to have him yammering on about how people need to obey or die is a little fucking
rich. You know, and this is something we see from the Trump administration in many, many instances where it's essentially... I don't know what I would call it, regulatory gaslighting, perhaps, yes. Which is like, he's like, the problem is you guys, and you are just claiming we're all fascists. And so it's your fault. We have to kill you.
Yes. It's like, exactly. What? It's like, it's just a brand of abuser politics.
Yeah. 100%.
Right. Like, the problem is not me. Right. The problem is not my violent use of force. The problem is you pointing out I am violently using force. Right. And attempting to tell me to stop.
Right. And this type of gaslighting, it's so interesting when you're reading the litigation and you see it going on in the litigation as well, mm-hmm. in so many different areas coming out of this administration and their efforts. And as now we've had, 18 months of the new Trump administration, we really are getting this long record of where they're going things. And I think to a significant degree, we're finally seeing the realization of, ADF and that ilk's efforts for impact litigation and how they've been changing things. Yeah. The precedents are there from Trump 1. And it is getting to the point where it's like, what is real anymore?
Right. Yes. Right. Exactly. It's wild. So speaking of just like making shit up in courts, so we've thus far kind of mostly been focused on the executive branch and immigration, but there is some going on in the courts as well. So the Fifth Circuit, America's worst circuit court, also jumped into the fray. The Fifth Circuit decided to get up to no good in some cases that are related to the big mandatory detention issue that has been making its way through several courts, an issue on which there is now a circuit split that will likely be resolved by the Supreme Court in the near future, which should cause a chill down the spine of everyone who cares about civil rights and liberties. Emily, but since you gestured to this, the detention conditions, could you remind people like what the issue in these cases is?
So last summer, around July of 2025, ICE adopted this unprecedented mass detention policy in which it said it would detain, it not only would, but it had to detain tens of thousands of people who had been in the U.S. for a long time. People, these are not people who have criminal records, right? They're just like people who have been living here, people who have children, people who have been contributing, and they're going to be held in detention without bond, subjecting essentially them to indefinite detention. Yeah. So for the last like 30 or so years, most administrations have understood a provision in federal law that required the government to detain without bond only people who crossed the border illegally. And there's sort
and
of
recently,
two,
yeah.
And recently, right? Like there's two provisions. Are you in A or B? Are you an applicant for admission or are you a person arrested in the interior? Right. And now the Trump administration has been arguing that mandatory detention without bond applies to everybody. Because if at any point you enter the US, you are then an applicant for admission. And it doesn't matter whether that's 1 month or 30 years ago. Yeah. And having US citizen spouses or children or, perfect attendance at check-ins, that doesn't matter. And the vast, literally hundreds, 400 federal district judges have rejected this argument.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, we are having a circuit split. There's been a really complicated sort of argument over substance and process and constitutional questions and different courts are deciding these cases on different merits and different legal grounds. And so I think you're 100% right. Whereas like there's only one outcome here.
Yeah.
And that's, I don't know, hopefully Robert's writing a decision.
I don't even know if that would guarantee a correct outcome. But there have been some previous immigration cases where the court was skeptical of theories that reversed, let's say, several decades interpretations of immigration law. So at least there is that going for it. But as I said, the Fifth Circuit waded in. But actually, like, even a panel of the Fifth Circuit concluded the federal government could not indefinitely detain without bond all of these people because doing so would violate the federal constitution. But because this is the Fifth Circuit where both the Constitution and all good things go to die, the en banc Fifth Circuit vacated that opinion within a week and set the case for a super fast en banc rehearing this fall, like rehearing before the full court. But even that was not enough. So the federal government filed with the Fifth Circuit what it called a motion to stay district court judgments. Did that more than 3 months after the district courts had entered said judgments, when in the interim, the people in those cases had been living peacefully in the United States at home in their communities with family and friends. And the federal government asked for a stay from the Fifth Circuit when they had not asked the district court for a stay, which under the appellate rules, you are supposed to have to do in order to get one from the appellate court. The government also asked for a precedential order to block all due process habeas claims by people in the Fifth Circuit, even before the en banc court fully considers the merits. And the Fifth Circuit granted it. But in true Fifth Circuit fashion, this is what I'm talking about when I said making shit up, they issued a published decision with zero reasons and zero opinion. This makes zero fucking sense. A precedential published stay order with zero reasons is not a thing. It's like if the Fifth Circuit just stood up and said, I declare bankruptcy, but they were like, I declare there's no due process. That's, I think, like the equivalent of what they did. And as far as I'm aware, and as far as other people I've spoken to about this are aware, like, this just has not happened elsewhere. I do wonder where this appellate court got the crazy idea that they could go ahead and just impose their views ASAP on the litigation before actually resolving the issue. That was me looking at you, John Roberts, and SCOTUS shadow docket. But the Fifth Circuit really took this to the next level, since they are always the worst and doing the most.
I don't know, Leah.
It's not a thing.
And like, what is there to say? Like, you're not supposed to be doing this. Your judges are supposed to be issuing decisions from which we can understand your reasoning and rationale and from which we can establish precedent. And it's like,
no, it's just like fiat diktats, right? Like, this is not precedent.
It's just, she is too stunned for words, you guys.
Yeah, it is Michael Scott. It is Michael Scott serving as a judge. That's what it is.
It is, right. And, you know, and I feel really, really bad because for the people who are being impacted by this. There was a brief moment in which there was a 90-day clock on this detention, right, and they had their lawyers trying to get them out. And my understanding is people who got their papers in time are being able to get out under that 90-day clock for the brief duration for which it was the presiding law, and now they're SOL. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, it's like, being in detention isn't in and of itself a punishment.
Yes. Yep.
And again, it's because the goal of the administration is to force people out of this country as quickly as possible. Yep. In the same way, these masked ICE agents that looked like really shitty characters in a video game are physically assaulting people when they arrest them. It's because you should want to not be arrested. I just saw... you know, by ICE agents. And that is why they're doing it over and over and over again, and why they hired these absolutely bonkers people. I mean, this guy in Maine who murdered someone, when you look
multiple
at his...
multiple ex-wives coming forward saying, it's crazy.
One of the ex-wives is like, I have been telling law enforcement for many, many years that he should not be employed in this capacity and no one would listen to me. I told you this was going to happen. It's like...
Yes.
It's so very bad. I just saw a video right before we started recording of a mother whose child is being taken by these masked men, and she's just screaming, hysterically crying. And we got on this call, and I was a little stopped for words because I had just watched this video. And, you know, I'm not saying this is new information. We've all seen these videos over and over again. But every single time you see them, it's just so appalling.
Yes.
It's so appalling that I literally lack sufficient words to describe my feelings about it.
Yeah. And like you can read the descriptions, you can watch the videos, and even like reading the description of the child in the bluey pajamas, right? Asking for their parent who has just been shot and killed by it's excruciating, but you have to read it. Like you have to watch it because this is happening and right, you need to know and you need to be able to tell other people about it in order to make clear this is not how we want things to work.
Well, and I think that the administration has made some very strategic moves with regards to lowering the temperature a little bit to get people to not pay attention.
Exactly.
And then they're starting to ramp things up. Yep. Stephen Miller is, as always, a evil and strategic human being, and he is masterminding behind the scenes, in my opinion.
Yeah. Strict Scrutiny is brought to you by ZBiotics. Between work, family responsibilities, and everyone needing something from you all day, oh, and then there's, you know, the state of our constitutional democracy, getting together with friends can feel like a form of self-care, whether it's a glass of wine at dinner or a long overdue girls' night. I make sure to drink ZBiotics pre-alcohol before alcohol so I can enjoy the evening and feel ready for whatever tomorrow brings. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's a buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night, to drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. The weekends I say yes to are always a ton of fun, but for me, they're even better when I end the weekend with energy still intact. No couch rotting required. So I can be my usual cray-cray self and get up at 4 a.m. during the week, the next day, swim, and start fiendishly working. Yes, that actually is the tomorrow I work for. And you can drink like there's a tomorrow with ZBiotics pre-alcohol. Go to ZBiotics.com/strict for 15% off your first order. My job is pretty intense during the week, or at least I'm pretty intense about it. So when Friday hits, I want to actually enjoy going out with friends. But I can't wake up the next morning feeling completely wrecked. ZBiotics pre-alcohol has become my little insurance policy. July is packed with barbecues, fireworks, lake weekends, and late nights with friends. Keep the good times rolling into the next day. Drink pre-alcohol before you go out and wake up ready for whatever Sunday brings. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/strict and use the code STRICT at checkout for 15% off. Strict Scrutiny is brought to you by Sundays for Dogs. Have you ever actually looked at the ingredient list on your dog's food? Stuff of nightmares for a dog mom. After the first ingredient, it might as well be in Martian, or some word vomit like Truth Social post a la Covfefe. You see, kibble is made using extreme high heat to keep its shelf stable and inexpensive. So brands have to add back synthetic vitamins and minerals in the form of strange chemicals whose names you do not understand and definitely cannot pronounce. Is that really what you want your dog eating? That's a no for me, dog. Sundays for Dogs is different. Founded by Dr. Tori Waxman, Sundays was created to meet her high standards as a veterinarian and as a dog parent. Sundays starts with 80% plus all natural meats and then adds superfoods such as kale, ginger, and blueberries. No fillers. No nutritional blends, no chemicals, just simple, complete nutrition. Sundays is gently air-dried instead of using high heat, so it doesn't look or smell like dog food. It looks like high-quality human-grade jerky. And the best part? Sundays requires no fridge, no freezer, no prep, no mess. You get the quality of a home-cooked meal with the convenience of a scoop and serve, a la kibble. It's what dog food should have been all along. And Sundays just launched a brand new fish recipe. It's made with 80% whole and minced fish, including eco-friendly invasive carp sourced from American rivers for a naturally rich flavor. In fact, did you know that many dogs naturally prefer fish flavors? So Sunday's fish recipe is especially great for picky eaters. Plus, it's packed with omega-3 fatty acids that help support healthy skin, shiny coats, joints, and brain function. It's complete and balanced nutrition for all life stages. Stevie loves her Sundays. It gives her the crunch of kibble and goes in her fun puzzle toys, and it leaves her feeling fresh and fly. I personally think her ears look even floofier with Sundays, and I would know since my entire phone is just pictures of her. Make the switch to Sundays. Go right now to sundaysfordogs.com/strict and get 50% off your first order. Or you can use code STRICT at checkout. That's 50% off your first order at sundaysfordogs.com/strict. sundaysfordogs.com/strict or use code STRICT at checkout. Back to the Fifth Circuit, because they were not done even after doing all of this precedential, unreasoned, precedential stay order that is an opinion without reasons. So they also, sitting en banc, decided they are going to decide whether this federal statute that prohibits people with felony convictions from possessing firearms violates the Constitution's Commerce Clause, on the ground that it potentially exceeds Congress's power to enact laws under the Commerce Clause. If you're thinking, wait, a federal gun law, maybe exceeding Congress's powers under the Commerce Clause, where have I heard this before? It would be in a concurrence by Clarence Thomas, who floated this idea in Hamani. Because if taken seriously, it would mean that a bunch of other federal laws, like federal civil rights laws, also violate the Constitution's Commerce Clause because Congress doesn't have the authority to enact them.
Yeah, also child pornography laws.
Yes, child pornography laws.
Explosives, biological weapons, IP, financial regulation. Like, they're all resting. Like, we're
a bunch
not
of regulatory
have
laws clause? Protecting, like, health, safety, welfare. Right.
One of the judges, I think, said, can felons from the other 11 circuits now flood the Gulf Coast to rearm themselves?
It's, oh, God.
Thomas does this, right? This is
yes.
his concurrence in Dobbs. Wakes me in my nightmares at least once a week when he said, let's reconsider Griswold, Loving, Obergefell, etc. Yeah. He didn't say Loving, but I put that in there. Once Griswold goes down, they all go down,
yes.
Justice Thomas. But, you know, he loves to make these little signals of how he'll decide future cases. And Hamani was a harbinger. I think that our Second Amendment interpretation over the last couple of years has been inconsistent, I would say. For
that's a generous word, but yes.
and with Hamani, I think we saw, you know, what this court's plans are with the Second Amendment, and that is to slowly eradicate any form of gun violence prevention legislation we have in this country. Yeah. And if this case goes where Justice Thomas wants it to go, it is, again, chilling. I fundamentally don't understand how it could happen. Like, to get rid of the Commerce Clause hook, you're gutting everything. I do think it's a type of thing that Justice Thomas would want. I don't see the other justices standing with him, but it is chilling nonetheless.
Totally chilling. And the Fifth Circuit is into it. They, too, are jonesing for a Commerce Clause freak-off. But it's not just the Fifth Circuit. Unfortunately, like, other circuits are also trying to make a run for America's worst circuit, and that includes on due process issues. So let's just go to the Second Circuit for a second. They decided to get in on the anti-due process wave. In a unanimous opinion, that court weighed in on one of the cases where a non-citizen had been swept into the administration's anti-Palestine fervor. This particular case involved Moshe Madawi, an individual whom the Trump administration decided to detain, arrest, and begin trying to remove when he showed up for his regular and required immigration check-in, a naturalization interview.
You know, and essentially what this case is deciding is that the government can use detention as punishment, right? Mm-hmm. And that
exactly.
is fundamentally, it's, you know, self-deport, rather endure the grinding aftermath of a removal order. And that's what this is allowing.
Right, because what they say is the federal courts, they cannot hear the constitutional claim that Madawi raised to challenge his detention. They were like, no, you have to do that in the immigration proceedings. But if you have to do that in the immigration proceedings, it's not going to be resolved until they decide whether to remove you, i.e. you are going to be detained potentially throughout that super lengthy process. One of the Trump appointees on the panel, Judge Menasche, issued a real pick-me concurrence suggesting that even if the detention claim could be separated from the deportation claim, like the petitioner was arguing he couldn't be detained for reasons unrelated to why he couldn't be removed, the petitioner still couldn't challenge his detention because indefinite detention without legal review, I guess that means due process these days. That's why it's due process rather than due process. And that wasn't even the only audition this week. So Judge Lawrence Van Dyke of I Made an Amosexual Video Dissent Showing Me Assembling a Gun, and I once used the phrase, this case is about swinging dicks in a judicial opinion fame, he issued a dissent from a ruling where the Ninth Circuit said a public school could reprimand a social worker who displayed anti-trans books that the state views as discriminatory. And Judge Van Dyke, in dissent, wrote, quote, "The school official's real interest in censoring the speech in this case is something nefarious, to give children the false impression that all the adults in the school personally share the same woke perspective." Like, using woke in a judicial opinion, it's just, he could not be trying harder if he tried. Second Circuit, not even the only one trying to make their turn as America's worst circuit court, in what could be a preview of the Supreme Court's upcoming case about whether states can ban the AR-15 platform and other semi-automatic rifles. The Third Circuit invalidated New Jersey's ban on assault firearms. They are large capacity ammunition magazines that can hold more than 10 rounds of ammunition. And a concurrence by another Trump appointee, Judge Mady, cited Thomas Aquinas, like the originalist. I don't know why that guy's views have anything to do with the Constitution.
History and tradition.
Right. History and tradition. But like on some separate track than the Constitution itself. And it also cited, perhaps to explain what the F is going on, work on what's known as common good constitutionalism. This is the idea propounded by, you know, people on the right who don't think originalism is reactionary enough, that maintains the Constitution should be interpreted in ways that advance the common good. And what do they think advances the common good? You know, authoritarianism, subordinating women, discriminating against racial minorities, et cetera, because those are the outcomes, right? The common good constitutionalism seems to be achieving.
It's almost like they want a living constitution.
Almost, right? But of course, they would never say that.
Scalia rolling in his grave.
I realize they want a living constitution. Not a dead constitution, but they want all of us to be dead.
Yeah.
Right? So both and.
A living constitution based on the ideas of a bunch of dead people.
Yes.
Yeah. That they, yes. What they say those ideas are, right? Like, not representative, yeah. You know, in even the abortion litigation or the what I foresee as the upcoming contraception litigation that I also shows yeah. up in my nightmares. You know, they're like, oh, no one was having abortions. Like, on what planet are you on? You know what I mean?
Right.
I guess no men were having abortions.
Right. Yes.
Right. Like, that's right.
Right. Right. That was what they determined. And that necessarily resolved the entire case for them.
Yeah.
Because if men weren't doing it, what is the point? It can't be good.
I mean, and, you know, what is sex differences anyhow? It doesn't matter. And we're seeing that legally as well.
Yes, indeed. So maybe just for more men's, let's go to the lightning round of news that I'm just calling the men's category. Like, are the men's okay? First, I have another clip to show you. You've probably already seen this one, though. It's from Steve Scalise. It's gotten a good bit of publicity, but we couldn't not include it in the show because it's just so fucking absurd. And this is him attempting to defend the SAVE Act, a federal law that would disenfranchise many, many people by requiring them to, among other things, have proof of citizenship to vote.
When you think about something like Save America, which is at the heart of democracy, just saying, show picture ID to vote. For God's sake, you can't go get pasta at Olive Garden without a picture ID. Why not be able to show a picture ID to vote?
I don't know, Lisa. Last time I went to Olive Garden, they did not ask to ID me.
This is the question. I want to know what the fuck he is doing at an Olive Garden and with his all-you-can-eat pasta that they are asking for his ID. Right?
Like, they're like, sir, that is too many breadsticks.
I want to know, what is too many breadsticks? Or what do you have to do to get carded at the all-you-can-eat pasta?
Is he confusing drinking alcohol and voting?
That could be. I mean, maybe he just goes to Olive Garden sloshed, and so it all blurs together. I don't know.
I would say this. No one would look at Steve Scalise and think, hey, is he under 21?
Right. You know, so that also seems implausible.
The whole thing. Big question mark. Sometimes I wonder with these men, had he been to quote-unquote Olive Garden already that day?
Right. Well, since we are in the Are the Men's Okay segment, no segment like this would be complete without a mention of one Pete Kegsbreath. At this point, you've probably heard about Kegsbreath's new testosterone policy for the military, the no-low-T military, as he called it, or in his words. This is, I mean, again, you just like have to hear it and see it to believe it.
I'm authorizing a new screening program for testosterone deficiency for our service members, ensuring you have the right testosterone levels to operate at your absolute best.
Number one, this is so embarrassing for him.
It is so embarrassing.
Like, especially when you see those videos of him doing his like little push-ups and pull-ups and exercises. And like, I look better doing my bicep curls than Petey over here. There's also, of course, a legal tie-in here. And we are seeing, you know, I'm sure all of you listeners are immediately thinking, hey, what are you saying? That people in the military should be able to get testosterone? That seems inconsistent from your other statements. And you would be on the nose. Judge Anna Reyes has made similar points that it seems that the DOD's basis for treating trans men and other service members differently between this new policy and the military ban is a question mark that she wants to pursue. Obviously, it is pharmacologically the same intervention, ongoing hormone therapy with monitoring. And on the internet, what we hear everyone say is like, oh, sounds like gender affirming treatment.
But, it both is, right, like the availability of testosterone, but also isn't, because to the extent this is like mandatory and enforced on people against their will, it's like compulsory rather than something you get with your healthcare. Right. I don't know what he's envisioning, but it's just all kinds of fucked up.
Can you imagine like the T rankings that are going to come out?
Oh God.
You know,
oh my
and
God.
Like these service members are going to be comparing their T numbers. Their T levels, and I just imagine the way these men talk about women in the locker rooms are going to start talking about each other and their T levels.
Yeah.
How big is your T level?
Oh, my God. Spilling the tea might unfortunately take on a very bad additional meaning.
Ugh. Ugh. So, also, it's just like we're in the middle of a $37 billion unconstitutional war. Pete Hegseth, don't you have other things you should be doing?
No, this is his number one priority, maintaining a high T military. Strict Scrutiny is brought to you by OneSkin. We've talked before about why OneSkin really stands out as a skincare company. The founding team are longevity researchers who asked a deceptively simple question. If many visible signs of aging, like wrinkles, fine lines, and loss of elasticity, are driven by so-called zombie cells, what if you could actually reduce those cells to slow the aging process down instead of just covering it up? That research led to OS1. OneSkin's proprietary peptide. It's the first ingredient proven to switch off those damaged senescent cells, actually slowing skin aging directly at the source. This science fits easily into my existing routine, and every time I use OneSkin, I'm giving my skin deeper hydration, barrier support, and visibly healthier skin long term. And with summer here, that matters even more, because up to 80% of visible skin aging starts with sun exposure. But OneSkin's new limited edition summer bundles have you covered. It's their skincare and SPF essentials paired together. So the OS1 peptide is helping to reverse the visible effects of UV aging, while you're also getting SPF protection from new damage. It's a complete system to summer-proof your skin. So make sure to check these out before they're gone. Now that summer is here, I'm relying even more on OneSkin's SPF with their OS1 peptide. It allows me to swim protected without making me feel like I am polluting the pool with my skincare and coverage. And this isn't just my experience. OneSkin's results are backed by 4 peer-reviewed clinical studies, over 10,000 five-star reviews, and they've been recognized by Bloomberg as a leader in skin longevity. You really don't need a complicated routine to get healthier, younger-looking skin. Born from over a decade of longevity research, OneSkin is helping you unlock your healthiest skin now and as you age. For a limited time, try OneSkin with 15% off using code STRICT at oneskin.co/strict. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code STRICT. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Strict Scrutiny is brought to you by Cook Unity. Okay, I recently tried the restaurant She-Wolf for the first time in Detroit. No joke, I had the best pasta of my life there. It was a light olive oil sauce with spicy red pepper flakes flavors. I'm not going to be able to pronounce the name of the dish, but hopefully that gives you a sense of it. It's also part of the chef's experience, so it won't be listed on the menu. But She-Wolf is 45 minutes away, and I certainly cannot recreate that dish at home. All the more reason for Cook Unity. Cook Unity is the first chef-led meal delivery service that makes your meals in small batches inside local micro kitchens across the United States, not factories. So every dish arrives with the kind of freshness you'd get at the restaurant itself. They have meals from Michelin-starred chefs, James Beard winners, and Food Network stars. Go to cookunity.com/strict or use code STRICT before checkout for 50% off your first week. I'm still obsessed with the mission-style burritos that Cook Unity offers. They're hearty, and I love the sauce that comes with it. They offer that nice, like, creamy counter the sauce does to the burrito. I also like the gingery salmon cakes. Little known fact, I love ginger, and I could taste the ginger in the meal. The food tastes like someone just made it for you because someone did in a small batch that morning. Cook Unity uses real culinary talent cooking in real kitchens, not a brand slapping a chef's name on a factory product. And they work with some of the best chefs in the country to bring creative, delicious meals to your door. And there are hundreds of dishes to choose from. Taste what happens when real award-winning chefs make fresh, small-batch meals just for you. Go to cookunity.com/strict or enter code STRICT before checkout to get 50% off your first order. That's 50% off your first order by using code STRICT or going to cookunity.com/strict. Next on the list of men's, Republican Senator Josh Hawley. He decided to make a referral to the Department of Justice in which he asked the DOJ to investigate Plan C. That is the informational educational resource that provides information about how to access abortion pills by mail from anywhere in the country. It's run by a nonprofit health campaign. Hawley says the website is in violation of federal law, in part because it recommends off-label use of the drugs and also how to access the drug in states that have abortion bans. This is, let's say, a dubious allegation slash interpretation of federal criminal law, but the point is it's federal criminal law and it's a threat that carries with it the prospect of jail time. And I wanted to highlight that because it underscores something we have talked about on the pod that had been flagged by a wonderful, relatively new independent news source that we've also highlighted before. And the point is this, we are all in this together, trans rights edition, because if you think that these goons and weirdos are going to limit their vitriol to trans people and trans sports bands, you have another thing coming. What Hawley is trying to do here is run the same playbook against medication abortion providers that the Trump administration has been trying to run against providers of gender-affirming care, accusing them of criminal conduct by making available or recommending prescriptions for off-label use, i.e. for a drug to be used in ways other than the manufacturer labels the drug. That allegation is behind some of the Trump administration's harassing subpoenas for medical records related to hospitals that provide gender-affirming care. And it was a playbook that could always be used against other healthcare providers, disfavored ones, specifically reproductive healthcare providers, as Garnett Henderson warned in March over at Autonomy News. That's a relatively new independent news site. Again, Autonomy News, great new website whose work we've highlighted before. Previously, they're reporting on the temporary fallout from the Supreme Court's delay in issuing their medication abortion ruling from this past spring. Emily, I know you had also been following other developments on the relationship or connection between trans rights and abortion rights.
Yeah, and frankly, there's just so many different things I could talk about right now. It's, I don't even know which one to start with. Before I get into answering your question, I do want to say I have some good news on this topic.
Yes, the ruling invalidating the restrictions on mifepristone.
Yes, yeah. Rare, I feel, to be able to say something positive. So we have a good case.
This is from a federal court.
Yeah. So we have a good case coming out of Virginia that essentially says FDA restrictions on mifepristone are capricious. Yeah. And the FDA needs to go back and make sure that people have, there's new regs to make sure that people have access to mifepristone as an abortion medication. And it's a really good decision and it's really well written and really interesting. It is also inevitably going to be setting up the circuit split that we are going to see that will run this case up to the Supreme Court. But I think that that's what we've all been expecting all these years. There's multiple other cases against the FDA trying to get the FDA to overrule the 20-year allowance of mifepristone. You guys have discussed this many times on this pod. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, though I remain passionate about the topic. So there was one other case. The Supreme Court granted cert in this case called International Partners for Ethical Care, Inc. versus Ferguson. And this is about a bunch of parents are bringing this case because the existence of homeless programs for runaway children and those programs offering gender-affirming care to those runaway children, the mere existence of that is a threat to their parental rights. And one of the things they cite in this case, and that we saw some of the Georgias picking up on, is a Texas case called Deanda, and that is about the parental right to not have other people handing out birth control to teenagers. For those of us like me who are fixated on the overturning of Griswold as a long-term impact litigation strategy, that case sort of sticks out there as one of the first things to fall. But there's just a complete and utter overlap. I mean, the Venn diagram is a circle between these anti-birth control cases and the trans rights cases, because the goal, like, parental rights and also religious freedom are the two main arguments they are going to be using to take all of this down. And we're seeing it in, you know, across the spectrum in all of these cases. And it's about healthcare and it's about the right to bodily autonomy. And, you know, there's a lot to be said when we're thinking about the future of contraception litigation from Scrimeti, right? Like the recent Supreme Court case on trans rights. And so I think that when we're going back to one of my favorite topics, like the Dobbs decision of history and tradition and who gets to decide what is constitutional in this country, it's a bunch of dead men, apparently, except for when they're not. But that's fine, except for when it's for the common good. Yeah. But that is the right, like the infrastructure that they are setting up under which they are going to decide these future cases.
I should say, again, as Emily was saying, so much to say about the relationship between, you know, these different rights that are under attack. I did a YouTube short video with Kate Riga at Talking Points Memo last week, you know, and we covered even more of it. But on the Are the Men's Okay? Another frequent flyer in this segment from the liquor DEI cabinet, and that would be RFK. And now diarrhea, two words that apparently do belong together. So in case you haven't heard this one yet, America is in the shitter. There is an outbreak of explosive diarrhea that's been traced to a foodborne parasite. And some contact tracing suggests the parasite might have, you know, gone through, right, or been distributed through some lettuce from a Taylor farm. So the actual lettuce has tested negative and there isn't a positive test on that lettuce.
I want to say, one of my takeaways from this whole thing is I have personally been so confused about what's happening. Like, I too don't want the explosive diarrhea, so have been on an individual level trying to figure out what to avoid.
Right.
And it's like you don't even know who to trust, because first the FDA says it's this lettuce, then they're like, it's Taco Bell. I don't eat Taco Bell, so that's fine. And they're like, no, wait, it's bagged lettuce.
Yeah.
And then it's like, no, it's not bagged lettuce. And of course, you know, there's lots of other information in the ether. The FDA was supposed to have a food traceability final rule that was going to be implemented, but at the beginning of the Trump 2.0 term, the FDA announced an intent to delay the implementation of that. Coincidentally, just, you know, around the same time, the head of Taylor Farms made a very, very large donation to Make America Great Again PAC. Coincidental, almost surely. It was about tariffs, apparently. Yeah. And, you know, to combine that with the gutting of the FDA done by the Trump administration, it's like, this is a huge problem. We are not seeing the public communications, the tracing of things. RFK said on a podcast, like, oh, there's an explosive diarrhea outbreak every summer. It's just same old, same old.
There is not an explosive diarrhea outbreak every summer, at least as far as I know.
Not as far as I know. And, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, actually, I would like to see the government working to end explosive diarrhea outbreaks. You know what I mean?
End like, explosive diarrhea. Sounds like a winning message.
And I have heard it is very bad. Like, it is. People are like, it is. This is not your normal explosive diarrhea.
Yeah. You know, I said RFK, part of the DEI cabinet, we've called it dicks, ex-husbands, and imbeciles. Now maybe diarrhea for everyone through incompetence. Also, measles are up. So much going on.
And I read today that the thing is now being traced to cilantro and parsley in North Carolina. So it's going to new vegetables. Oh, I said, once it gets to the berries, the berry mamas will end this, and I hope that's the case. Okay. Berry mamas, we need you.
Okay.
Save me from the explosive diarrhea.
Yeah. I don't even want to know what Maha has to say about this, but
they're probably like, it's a cleanse.
Yes. Just going down our list of men's, just because why not? This behavior seemed to fit on the list. It's been reported that Bryson DeChambeau, a golfer, reportedly wanted Donald Trump to intervene after he received a penalty at the Open Championship. Like, he threw a temper tantrum, refusing to sign a scorecard, holding the tournament hostage, and apparently relayed his request to Donald Trump. Again, are the men's okay? Like, this is not, like, if you lose some sort of sports match, the solution is not to call the president to have him rig it for you. And yet this seems to now be a go-to move.
You know, one more thing for me to hate the Trump administration about: they're making me have to learn about sports.
Just so you can understand how they're fucking it up too.
It's like, I had to pay attention to the FIFA red card of it all. Yep. What a nightmare for me.
Yeah. The hardship, the burdens we all carry. You know, one last one, and this is definitely in a different category, which is why I put it last, but still wanted to note it. Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan were rearrested in Miami, and British officials are seeking their extradition on charges of rape and sex trafficking. Instead of attempting to describe who Andrew Tate is and what he and his brother have allegedly done, I want to re-recommend Heidi Blake's piece from The New Yorker, Andrew Tate's Empire of Abuse. I really don't think it is coincidental that the brothers came under subsequent scrutiny after that piece came out, given how deeply it was reported and all of the allegations, horrifying allegations it describes. Mr. Kate Shaw, aka Chris Hayes, also did a Why Is This Happening podcast episode with Heidi Blake about her reporting. So definitely check out both of those.
The Tate, I don't know which one, one of the Taints, said, Taints? They were like,
did you say Taints? I'm going to use that. That's good.
Thanks. I'm finally catching on to the scrutiny name calling. It's taken me a couple episodes.
You keep it classy, right, and keep it subtle, and then you just slide it in, and then it gets picked up in the lingo. The Taints, the Taint brothers.
Catching on. Before you guys know it, I'll be one of the gals. One of them was like, we called Barron. Why? We thought right. that he'd get this solved. It's like, oh. I mean, look, when you look at the people who are surrounding the Trump brothers and who they spend their time with, this is not shocking, right? Yeah. That these types of men would assume that they can call and get special treatment. And, you know, per the previous segment on the sports of it all, clearly the Trump administration does offer the people special treatment. Yes. And so I can't imagine why they wouldn't expect this to happen. They got special treatment the first time. Yes. Why won't they get special treatment this time? And to be clear, these people deserve to rot in hell. And I hope they are served with indefinite detention, which is apparently now legal.
Right. Unfortunately, I'm not sure it's for men's like the Taint brothers. They due process, not due process or something like that. So, Emily, before I let you go, would you like to share your favorite things, your recent favorite things with our listeners?
I would. I'm always reading a few good books. One book that I'm very, very late on, but I did just finally finish this week, was Careless People.
Which, that's a good one.
It was a very good book, and I highly recommend. I thought that was a very, very good read. On the more fiction side, I also, again, very late on it, finished God of the Woods.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
Which is also
one too.
An excellent, excellent book. It is my book club book. My book club always chooses excellent books, and so those are two of my suggestions. There's also a new show that I just had a brain freeze on, Ride or Die, which is Octavia Spencer and Hannah Waddingham, and it is so, so good. I haven't finished it yet, but I highly recommend that series. It was a real pleasure. And I do believe multiple years ago I was on your pod and I made the same suggestion because it's my single favorite summer recipe, but it is the Smitten Kitchen zucchini pasta.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's great. What? You know what it is? It's still incredible. It's, you know?
And for new listeners, they get the benefit of this too.
For new listeners, make a little tomato galette with like heirloom tomatoes and then serve it with the zucchini pasta with fresh fettuccine. And it is to die for. And pretty much what I live, maybe a sweet corn also. And it's just the perfect summer meal.
Yeah, that sounds delicious.
Yeah.
Okay, so I will go in a similar order. I'll start with the book. So I was on vacation. I read the Off-Campus series. Enjoyed it immensely, except for book four. I didn't love book four. I also read Julianne Long's new one, Game of Rogues. Loved it. And now the like more serious ones. Going to re-recommend Heidi Blake, Andrew Tate's Empire of Abuse, and Chris Hayes and Heidi Blake on her reporting. Also recommend Autonomy News, the new website. They're doing important reporting. There was a great state Supreme Court decision out of Hawaii that really captured the aloha spirit. It rejected the idea that the Hawaii Supreme Court should interpret their state constitution in the same way that the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted the federal constitution. The Hawaii Supreme Court said they weren't going to adopt the guidance of a court that defines federal due process, you know, that honors the work of 1857, i.e. Dred Scott, and called, you know, the Roberts Court's actions, quote, white noise, said they only see white. Just pages and pages of these Kendrick-level disses and grievances, definitely worth checking out. And then on a slightly lighter note, one other law stuff. The transcript and the reporting out of the federal court hearing involving the administration subpoenaing New York Times journalists. I don't know if you saw this, the ones like reporting on Trump's use of the Qatari jet, the Amalia jet or whatnot. Okay. The government ultimately withdrew the subpoenas of the journalists, and the hearing sounds completely epic. So Matthew Russell at Inner City Press reported this. Here's some of what apparently unfolded. So the judge says, "You didn't tell the judge that the subpoena was about reporters, about the New York Times?" Federal government lawyer, "We did not. It was an oversight. Later, we did legal research." Incredible, right? This is supposed to be like the best U.S. attorney's office in the country, the Southern District of New York. And they're like, yeah, we didn't really do legal research before we like saw the subpoena. We like did it after.
Later, we asked ChatGPT.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. At another point, they seem to suggest like they had accidentally subpoenaed the records of one of the reporter's mothers. So the judge is like, "You're saying there was no attempt to find out these were the numbers of mothers and spouses?" And the lawyer says, "That was an error. We own it. That was a mistake. Not in furtherance of the investigation. Oopsies."
You know what? Here's the thing. If any of you listening ever have felt imposter syndrome,
right?
I hope that this story kills that for you.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Just know, it takes nothing now. Apparently, you can just bring a case. Don't do legal research. Nope. Don't figure out who you're going after. It doesn't matter. It's fine. You just tell the judge, whoopsie, oopsies.
Exactly. You oopsie, fire up those subpoenas and see what comes.
Maybe. Make the
boss
happy.
It's hot subpoena summer.
I mean, at least you get the headline, right?
Right. Exactly.
The Fox News segment.
Yes. Well, Emily, thank you again so much for joining again, listeners. Emily Amick, you can find her on Instagram and Substack at Emily in Your Phone and get her book, Democracy in Retrograde. And we hope to hear more from you soon.
Thanks, Lee. I appreciate it.
And now stay tuned for a conversation I had with EEOC Commissioner Kalpana Kodagal. This episode of Strict Scrutiny is brought to you by Alloy Health. Here's something nobody tells you. The skin changes that start in your 40s aren't just aging. They're hormonal, specifically estrogen loss. Estrogen naturally helps maintain collagen, support elasticity, and keep skin hydrated. As estrogen declines, skin gets thinner, drier, and more crepey. And this isn't like the good kind of Nutella crepes. It means your expensive cleanser, retinol, moisturizer, none of them were designed to solve what's a hormonal problem. I was recently in my 20-year college reunion, and some friends and I were looking at freshman year photos, and I was like, who is that 12-year-old? Seriously, my skin just looked different, like self-buoyant, fuller. I've tried moisturizers, peels, but eh. It's just no good that skin feels thin, dry, dull after 40. And nobody told us our routines needed to change. Worse, there didn't used to be solutions. But now there's M4 Skincare from Alloy, the first head-to-toe line of estriol-powered skincare. Estriol is a safe, gentle, and bioidentical form of estrogen, clinically proven to rebuild collagen, restore elasticity, and visibly reduce wrinkles. For M4 face cream, 88% of users saw improved elasticity. For M4 body treatment, 95% felt smoother skin. The full line targets face, eyes, body. Estrogen-powered skincare everywhere you notice changes. It's prescription strength without the appointments, pharmacy trips, or insurance hassle. It's also HSA and FSA eligible, delivered free to your door. So it works like this. You complete your intake. M4 is available by prescription. So you'll start with a quick online form. Then you get your prescription. You'll be matched with a menopause specialized physician who reviews your intake and prescribes what's right for your skin. Plus you get $0 unlimited messaging with your doctor. Hey girl, hey. Then M4 is delivered to your door. Once it's approved, your prescription ships straight to you. No pharmacy, no hassle. Try M4 skincare from Alloy and see results in as little as 8 weeks. Head to myalloy.com and use the code STRICT to get $20 off your first order. Your menopause specialized doctor will tailor your skincare to your needs. Plus you get $0 unlimited messaging with your doctor. Head to myalloy.com and use code STRICT to get $20 off your first order. For this segment, I am delighted to be joined by EEOC Commissioner Kalpana Kotagal. On the podcast, we have talked about the momentous significance of the Supreme Court solving the separation of powers in Trump versus Slaughter, by which I mean the cavalier demolition of independent agencies and the fallout that's likely to have. And we wanted to bring that to light slash life by talking about the specific fallout at one formerly independent agency, the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Welcome to the show, Commissioner.
Thanks, Leah. I'm super glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So for those who might not be familiar, can you share a little bit about what the EEOC is and why the agency matters?
Yeah, I absolutely can. I should just say at the outset that I'm only speaking for myself here today, obviously not for the commission as a whole. You know, we at the EEOC have our roots in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and in the civil rights movement. We've thought of ourselves for a long time as the nation's premier civil rights agency, and our job is basically to enforce the federal civil rights laws, right, which protect from discrimination on the basis of a bunch of different traits like race and sex, also disability, gender identity, sexual orientation, the list goes on. We are we're a charge-based agency, right? So what that means is that workers file charges and then EEOC staff investigate those charges to determine whether the civil rights laws have been violated, and then they might negotiate with employers to seek relief. You know, we also bring litigation, particularly in cases where the discrimination is really egregious or systemic, or where those workers may not be able to secure counsel outside the agency. Just to give you a sense of scale and scope, you know, to underscore the fact that discrimination is real and ongoing, we received more than 88,000 charges of discrimination last year alone and secured more than $660 million in relief for workers. So we're a little agency, but, you know, we punch way above our weight, I think, in terms of relief. You know, I think a lot these days, and have thought for a long time about sort of what the role of this agency is in modern times. And, you know, I think about the Civil Rights Act as really giving voice to some of our nation's highest ideals. And I think we know that that promise has not yet been fulfilled. And also, I think that underscores just how important it is that we have a fair and impartial EEOC. And I know we're going to talk a lot more about that now, you know, in the wake of Slaughter.
So let's go to that fair and impartial EEOC, because while the Slaughter decision just came down, it's actually reflected the status quo for some time, since the Supreme Court in Trump versus Wilcox had allowed the president to fire the heads of several multi-member commissions. That order came down on the shadow docket. So Trump had also fired Democratic appointees on the EEOC, and the firings were challenged in litigation, but Wilcox allowed the removals to proceed while litigation proceeded. And in any case, after Slaughter, the former EEOC commissioner dropped their lawsuit. All that is to say, you've been the lone Democratic commissioner at the agency for the past year and a half. So how has the president's removal of your fellow Democratic commissioners impacted your work?
Yeah, it's been a an interesting year and a half, as you can imagine. We've been really focused since January of 2025, when my colleagues were removed, you know, unprecedented by the president. Our presence at the agency, my team and I, feels like a huge It's a huge privilege, obviously, but a huge responsibility. And we're thinking about it in terms of the importance of continuing to advocate for marginalized worker communities, but also to describe, to express an affirmative view of civil rights, like one that's actually grounded, grounded in the law. You know, there remain workers across the country for whom the EEOC might be their only option to get relief for egregious harassment or for pregnancy discrimination. And so I think that hasn't changed, you know, from one administration to the next on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, there's a lot happening. And I think that means that my job at the agency has been to advocate for transparency as the administration rolls out these like major changes to the way the agency has operated and to its priorities. And then I spend a lot of time advocating on behalf of our career staff who are increasingly doing more with less, really mm-hmm. under the gun as so many federal workers are. And then I think really just constantly being vocal about the demands of the law. The reality is, of course, that every day my staff and I have to weigh whether voicing dissent is worth getting fired by the president. It's a strange way to go to work. And it's obviously not about me. It's not about my employment. I think it's really about the vital work that the agency does and that our workers do. And, you know, I think the reality is that if I'm fired or when I'm fired, there won't be anybody left at the agency to point out, you know, when the EEOC is straying from its mission and when it's mm-hmm. abandoning its responsibilities. And I worry all the time, right, about the public being left in the dark.
I want to come back to the straying from the mission in a little bit, but brief detour. I don't want to go j'accuse on you, but do you have any idea why you have not yet been removed?
I mean, you know, it's a great question. The White House, as you might imagine, hasn't really kept me in the loop on their thinking. But I think the bottom line is that
you're not on the signal chats.
I'm not on the signal chats. You know, I was the most junior of the Democratic commissioners. And so I think that's probably part of it. And then the other part is that if they removed all three of us, their path back to quorum, which is to say their path back to their ability to move this regulatory agenda and their litigation agenda would have gotten, you know, farther away. So I think those are probably the two reasons. I think, you know, the one thing I would say here is that when Congress confirms a third Republican commissioner, three is quorum at the EEOC.
Right.
I think it's likely I'll be fired. And then there won't be a Democrat left at the agency.
Yeah. So we'll come back to how they are using the agency, because this isn't a case where they might want to just have the agency do nothing, which is an important part of, you know, the loss of independence. But, you know, you expressed concern about the agency missing its mission, right? Ignoring its mission. So when the EEOC is straying from the law, who's getting rolled here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think Congress, there's no question, just as a starting point, right? And I know that you all have talked about this, like the what's the role of independent agencies. You know, Congress was clear, right, that there was a value to having agencies that had bipartisan representation, that there were some issues like civil rights, for example, or consumer protection that should be above partisan politics. And I think we've lost the thread there. I know, I think the other folks who are getting rolled, not surprisingly, are the American public, right? Civil rights enforcement is better when it has input from both parties, and that's been lost.
So since the American public is also losing out here, I did want to focus on some of the reporting we've seen about goings on at the EEOC and how the loss of independence has led to the loss of civil rights protections. And so just to tick through some examples, the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel issued what is, in my view, a bogus memo asserting that disparate impact liability is unconstitutional. It's also been reported that in September, the EEOC administratively closed all charges that solely implicate disparate impact pursuant to the president's executive order. So can you talk about what disparate impact is and why those changes matter for workers?
Yeah, I mean, I think disparate impact is just a perfect example, right? It's a perfect encapsulation of what happens when a civil rights agency loses its independence. It's no longer enforcing worker protective laws that happen to be, in this case, disfavored by this administration. You know, when we think about disparate impact, right, this is the way that we can challenge, that civil rights agencies and advocates can challenge policies that look neutral on their face, like, for example, a strength test, or perhaps the use of AI screening tools, right? That's the one I think we're going to be hearing a lot about. They look neutral on their face, but the reality is that they have an unfair discriminatory impact on certain groups. And that's what disparate impact allows us to challenge. It's not new, right? I mean, it goes back to 1971 in Griggs, and then was codified in the statute in 1991. And it's interesting. It was enforced during the first Trump administration.
Yes.
There's a big $20 million settlement from the EEOC involving a physical abilities test at Walmart that was discriminating against women workers. I think there's no question, and we can talk more about the details of that OLC opinion memo, but there's no question that the loss of disparate impact means that we're losing this vital tool to root out the kind of discrimination that's, I think, often hardest for workers to see.
Yes, right. And that's part of why, even if the charge is dismissed by the agency, just letting the worker, you know, still file suit is maybe not a great substitute, because they might not be in a position to see the bigger picture, right, and be able to assemble the full case.
That's exactly right. There's, like, I think two things. One, these are often expensive cases, right, because they involve complex statistical analysis, because they might involve retaining expert witnesses. This was something that I did before I joined the commission. This was the kind of litigation that I did. But as you say, also, the EEOC has much better information about this kind of discrimination than workers do. This is the kind of stuff that workers, it's the hardest thing for workers to be able to spot.
Yeah. Okay. So since you mentioned it, the OLC memo, alleging that disparate impact liability is unconstitutional. So I guess I would be curious to hear you talk a little bit more about that, because in my view, the issuance of that memo is really a key example about how the loss of independence is directly tied to this weakening of civil rights.
I think it's such a good point. You know, the part of the story that there are a bunch of pieces of the story here that I think were worth bringing out. But the first thing that I would note is that DOJ's OLC issued that opinion at the request of the EEOC's chair.
Right.
So, you know, it came from a request from this agency, this very agency that is supposed to be enforcing the law when it comes to disparate impact. You know, there are a lot of things about this memo that are bogus, but I think it really is at odds with the law. Honestly, you know, if you look as recently as 2015, right, in inclusive communities, the Supreme Court is recognizing the power and the validity of disparate impact. That was obviously a Fair Housing Act case. Well, I've had to read that opinion memo multiple times because it's quite frankly unintelligible, right? I mean, there's the ratcheting up of the standard for what it takes to prove disparate impact based on nothing that I can tell. Right. And then there's this constitutional analysis.
And after
that is
Congress
bogus.
Specifically ratcheted down the standard in response to a Supreme Court decision. Perfect example about how Congress is getting ruled here.
That's totally right. It's in the 1991 amendments to the Civil Rights Act. Congress did that to respond to 1980s decisions like Ward's Cove that it disagreed with. So, I mean, yes, perfect example of how Congress is getting rolled. Perfect example of how this Department of Justice and this EEOC are fundamentally disregarding the law. You know, I think when you like think about it, it feels, I mean, you know, we can look at Project 2025 too, but to me, it really feels like the outcome of this memo was predetermined.
Since you mentioned Project 2025, and we are talking about the loss of independence resulting in the loss of civil rights, you know, one particular trend that has been observed is the erosion of LGBTQ rights in particular. So it's been publicly reported that the commission is not investigating worker complaints of harassment based on gender identity. The agency also rescinded its harassment guidance, which explained that discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity is unlawful. What does that backtracking do?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's quite, I mean, it's devastating, right? It's shameful that the very agency that is supposed to be protecting the rights of these workers is abandoning them, in particular, trans workers. A couple of things have happened that I think are worth talking about at the EEOC. Last year, the agency directed, the chair directed staff to dismiss 7 cases that the EEOC had investigated and filed on behalf of trans and non-binary workers. You know, the kinds of harassment that these workers endured, it doesn't matter what your sexual orientation or gender identity, right? No one should have to endure this kind of harassment. You know, and I don't have to go into the details, obviously, but people being referred to as it, all kinds of unwanted touching and sexual advances. And imagine, right, like if you were those workers, they had their civil rights violated. They came to the agency that's supposed to protect their rights. And then they are literally re-victimized by having the agency abandon them in the process of their cases. I think it's obviously shocking, right? And it's really disheartening. You mentioned the harassment guidance, the rescission of that. That was literally done because it referenced protections from harassment for LGBTQ plus workers. A couple of other things that I think are worth noting. The agency has been reported refusing to investigate or to develop for litigation charges that arise under gender identity, right? Discrimination on the basis of gender identity. And so they're basically not being investigated and they're not being developed for litigation. You know, we don't have to drill too deep into the Bostock opinion, right, to see quite clearly that that LGBTQ plus workers are protected from discrimination under Title VII, including harassment. But the agency has left them, and I think in particular trans workers, to fend for themselves. I think one thing I would want to just make sure that folks hear is that even as the EEOC is backtracking, it's super important for employers not to do that.
Yes.
Not just because there are courts, but also because a future Democratic administration is going to come down on this. And probably most significantly, because it's just the right thing to do.
Indeed. Speaking of right thing or wrong thing, last week, the EEOC held a commission meeting on a proposal to rescind demographic data collection. The EEOC has collected race and sex data from large employers for 60 years, using the data to investigate race and sex discrimination. You argue that the proposal is, quote, an attempt to weaken equal employment opportunity and to undermine progress for women and historically marginalized communities. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, data is so important, right? It tells us so much. It paints the picture. And this is data that the agency has collected, as you said, since 1966, right? It's data that our staff use to drill down further, to look for trends, to understand where problems might arise, and to use the agency's incredibly scarce resources in the most efficient and effective ways. This is in Project 2025, this rescission. Yep. So, you know, not surprisingly, the commission is now proposing to rescind this data, despite how important a tool it is in our toolbox. I really see this as part of this larger attack from the administration on civil rights protections across the government. You know, this notice of proposed rulemaking, it just came out publicly to rescind this data. It offers, you know, as you might imagine, a number of explanations for the rescission, including the DOJ OLC memo on disparate impact. None of them are particularly that's right. That's exactly right. None of them are particularly compelling. It's quite remarkable. It takes the position that collecting demographic data somehow forces employers to make hiring and other employment decisions on the basis of protected traits. So hard to understand what the connection is there. There's literally no foundation or evidence for this, right? There's not one scrap, not one example of an employer somehow engaging in unlawful discrimination because they've collected and reported this demographic data for 60 years. They're also making these constitutional arguments grounded in the Equal Protection Clause that, again, don't have any basis, untethered from Supreme Court precedent. You know, what this is going to mean in reality, right, is that a short-staffed agency, tight resources to go get this data from employers for particular cases, right? It's going to require more information requests, yeah. more subpoenas, you know, more battling in court with employers who aren't going to want to produce it. So much for government efficiency, right? Like this feels like the exact apotheosis of that. And I think really is going to just make it harder for the agency to enforce the law to protect workers.
So the loss of data is going to hurt civil rights and harm workers. I guess just to make it concrete for people, is there an example of how this kind of data has been used to protect workers?
Yeah, there are a bunch, as you might imagine. Point just to one, we just settled a case in May of this year, $5.5 million settlement involving a big trucking company. It resolved allegations that for at least a decade, the trucking company had been hiring less qualified male applicants over more qualified female truck driver applicants. And if you look at the court filings in that case, it's quite clear that an analysis of that EEO-1 data is what contributed to the EEOC finding cause that discrimination mm-hmm. had occurred, right? And bringing this lawsuit. I think the other thing that is just important to say here is that there's no question that the administration is recognizing the value of getting demographic data when it serves their interests, right? Last mm-hmm. year, the chair of the EEOC demanded that 20 law firms produce a ton of demographic data to the agency, mm-hmm. You know, in line with these investigations about their DEI practices. And yeah. you know, just recently, the Education Department has announced that it's going to require universities to produce all kinds of demographic data to so-called, you know, test their compliance with SFFA. So yeah. there's no problem getting data in other circumstances. I want to say one more thing before yeah. I stop, which is that just because you stop collecting the data doesn't mean that the discrimination goes away.
Exactly.
Right.
Just
all that happens.
Prove.
Exactly. Is that we kneecap the agency, makes it harder right. to prove, makes it harder to enforce the law, and yeah. leaves workers behind.
Yeah. Since you mentioned, you know, the investigations into DEI, you know, as we were kind of alluding to up top, one possible explanation for why the administration doesn't want to deprive the EEOC of a quorum is that they would also perhaps like to weaponize the agency. So not just giving a free pass, you know, to some people to violate the law, but also maybe sicking dubious interpretations of the law, you know, against people in institutions they don't care for. And that has often meant taking this administration's culture war grievances and running them through the agency, particularly the attacks on DEI. So I guess yeah. before we just briefly talk about the weaponization concern, you know, what are some obviously legal DEI efforts?
Yeah, I mean, there are a bunch, right? And this administration has come for them. I think the thing about DEI practices is that the devil is always going to be in the details and it's yeah. always going to be in the execution, right? Like it has to be done correctly. But there are a whole set of practices that, if carefully undertaken, are lawful, right? Like expanding yeah. and broadening applicant pools, right? That's an obvious one. What about recruiting at HBCUs or standardizing interview questions and hiring and promotion criteria to make sure that everybody is on the same page, or using skills-based hiring, right, rather than relying yeah. on particular credentials? All of these are DEI practices. You know, so too is looking at demographic data, doing compensation analyses. All yeah. of these things help to decrease legal risk. And I think about them as really fostering, these are the things that actually foster a true meritocracy, mm-hmm. right? These are the things that break down barriers to equal opportunity to ensure that every single worker, regardless of their background, has a chance to work, to contribute, yeah. to contribute to their families and their economy. So there's like a whole raft, I think, of DEI practices. And the risk of rolling them back, right, is that we erase gains in the workplace
yes.
that have been made
yeah.
for women and people of color and people with disabilities, and the list goes on.
Yeah. So mentioned, you know, that one possible way of weaponizing the agency is basically doing these attacks on DEI. And the chair of the EEOC, Andrea Lucas, famously did a direct-to-camera video urging white men to submit complaints of DEI discrimination for money. Can you elaborate on how, you know, this kind of speaks to the stakes of the loss of independence and, you know, how the agency or commission can be weaponized?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite clear that this agency is just increasingly an arm of the White House, Like, I think that that's quite clear. Just to give you one example beyond the ones that, you know, you've mentioned about the chair's video, we have a new, at the EEOC, a new national enforcement plan, which enshrines these priorities of the administration, including remedying what they describe as DEI-related discrimination. It also includes defending the quote-unquote binary reality of sex. You know, this is where the decision not to investigate disparate impact is enshrined. Yeah. It also makes explicit that the EEOC is not an independent agency. So, right, these things are like clearly going hand in hand. I think it's worth really noting that under the guise or the language of prioritizing even-handed enforcement, which is what this chair likes to talk about, the reality is that the agency is redirecting limited resources toward prosecuting this administration's grievances and protecting this administration's most favored groups. And I think we see that happening on a day-to-day basis.
Well, obviously, there's a lot more to say. And actually, if you would like to hear more, you should check out YouTube, where I'm going to have an additional expanded conversation with the commissioner. But for now, Commissioner Cotegal, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss what the loss of independence has meant at the EEOC.
Thanks, Lee. I appreciate it.
It's clear that the sole remaining Democratic appointee on the EEOC is also one of my favorite things. So add that to my list, and that she should be one of all of our favorite things, although the fact that there is only one remaining Democratic appointee, not so much. Strict Scrutiny is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Melody Rowell and Michael Goldsmith. Jordan Thomas is our intern. Our team includes Matt DeGroat, Ben Hethcote, Johanna Case, Kenny Moffitt, Eric Shute, and our music is by Eddie Cooper. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America, East.